Hi, Cliff Goldstein here. Glad you came, made it to the show. You know, in the 21st century, we stand amazed, and rightly so, at the incredible achievements of science. One thing after another, one technical marvel after another. I mean, it never ends. Computers, think of the communication, even the iPhone. It's unbelievable. And then there's the internet. I mean, we're in the midst of a revolution. It's just unfolding before us. And all this is from the marvels of science. This is what science is doing for us. Of course, however, it's not as it was today, though, as it was around the turn of the 19th and 20th century. See, if we think science did a lot for us then, folks back there were rapturous about what science was going to do. You read the stuff around the turn of the century, and they just were thinking science was going to bring in a new utopia. It was going to cure war. It was going to cure disease. It was going to bring peace and harmony. I mean, it was amazing how optimistic they were at the beginning of the 20th century over all that they believed science was going to give. Well, there was the flip side, though, of science at that time. Because all the wonderful technology of science, suddenly you got World War I, where they were able to use science to kill people in numbers that they had never seen before. And if World War I was something, World War II, the ability to kill each other through science was multiplied over and over, and I think it climaxed. Well, we saw Auschwitz with what science was able to do, but the real climax of that was Hiroshima with the atom bomb. All this was from science. So suddenly, the optimism that they had about science after the turn of the century pretty much faded away, pretty much faded down. And I think we today, to say the least, we in the early stages of the 21st century, I think we can still marvel. It's amazing at what science does. I mean, I still sometimes pick up a cell phone and use my cell phone, and I find it amazing, or the GPS and all that. Yes, it's amazing to think of the technological advances that science has given to us. Yet I don't think anybody, as we're moving into the 21st century, looks at science the way they looked at it at the beginning of the 20th century, with this idea that science is going to somehow solve all our problems, or science is going to usher in some sort of utopian era, and it's going to solve everything, as folks believed 100 years ago. Instead, I don't know, folks, with some way science can be a little scary. It's almost like the advances and the success of science is a little scary. I mean, we got dirty bombs, we've got global warmings, we've got weapons of mass destruction. I mean, there is this whole ugly flip side to science that we deal with now in the 21st century. All that being said, though, even in the modern era, science, which was riding high, particularly after World War II, science has come into a lot of criticism in the past 30, 40 years. And there are three fronts where the criticism came in. All of a sudden, you know, I said after World War II, the government was pouring billions of money, the American government, billions of money into science because, you know, we developed atomic energy, we had industry, all this stuff was based on the hope of science and what science could do. Well, in the early 60s, there was starting to be criticism of science. There started a political criticism of it. You know, it was, you know, look what we were using science for in the Vietnam War and the whole military-industrial complex. And they were taking all the goodness of all the achievements of science and using it for evil ends. Now, these folks didn't question the utility of science. The question was how it was used. What was it being used for? For the military, for people making a lot of money. So suddenly science got this first major criticism. Then there was a philosophical attack on science about that same time, too. It was attacked by the postmoderns and postmodernism, and it attacked the whole idea of the objective of objectivity of science. You know, you got this idea of a scientist coldly and rationally extract facts about nature and then analyze them in this unbiased manner and come out with these universal, unchanging, objective truths about nature. About nature. This whole idea was attacked by the postmoderns. I mean, and I think they had some valid points. I mean, some went too far. I mean, some of them, you know, somebody once attacked Newton's Principia, his whole Principia, which laid the foundation of, you know, the study, you know, the laws of gravity. This one woman called it a rape manual. I mean, we're talking about the Principia. Another radical feminist attacked Einstein's E equals MC squared. She called it a sexist equation because it emphasizes the speed of light over other equations. So again, though, in fairness, this is some of the silliness of radical postmodernism. Nevertheless, men like Michel Foucault, Jacques Derrida, Thomas Kuhn, Paul Feyerabend, they were attacking science at a very philosophical level. And even non-postmoderns, people like Karl Popper and Michael Polanyi, questioned the assumptions of sciences and the premises and the conclusions of science. In fact, to this day, there's still a lot of debate over what is science as opposed to pseudoscience. I mean, how does science make the claims that what it makes as true or false? How do we know if a scientific theory is even correct? What assumptions must be made in order to even do science? What philosophical presuppositions must you have to do science? And if you have these presuppositions, what are they based on? And how culturally conditioned are these presuppositions? So this was essentially the intellectual postmodern attack on science, which to a certain degree is still going on. Then finally, there was a third attack on science, came from religion. Now, this was surprising me because many of the scientists pretty much thought religion was a spent force. It was passé. It was over. We were now in what Auguste Comte would have called the age of positivism. We were beyond all that. Nevertheless, with the rise of, you know, Christianity and certain strains of Christianity, there was assault by the creationists, an assault by intelligent design theorists, and they were hammering away at some of the claims, particularly about human origins, all made in the name of science. And we're living in the midst of that right now as well, this battle going on, and it's getting harder and harder, and it's not going to go away anytime soon. You see, in the end, there's some very basic and fundamental challenges to the whole scientific endeavor. Because if you think about it, science is, after all, it's empirical. We look around at the world, and we don't look around at the whole world, but we only look around at specific parts of it. And from our empirical data, you know, from looking and smelling and feeling and measuring these small sections of nature, we try to make conclusions about all of nature, about what's universal and necessary and certain. And it's not that easy. What makes you think that because something does X or Y in this part of the universe, that it must do X or Y in another part of the universe? I mean, you make an assumption about something here. What makes you think it's valid somewhere else as well? And then there's another problem with science, a basic logical problem. And the formal logicians call it, affirming the consequent, it's called. And it goes like this. I mean, I have a theory, a scientific theory. And if my theory is true, then X over there is going to turn green. Voila, X turned green. Therefore, my theory is true. Of course, it doesn't necessarily follow, does it? X could have turned green because of any number of reasons, none of which had anything to do with my theory. But see, it's not always easy to know or to disprove. I mean, I have a theory. I have a theory that invisible spiders from Mars have come down to Earth and they pull everything to the ground. So if I've got my book in my hand here and I drop my book, That's proved. Invisible spiders from Mars are here, and they've caused me to drop my book. Now, that might seem silly, and that's admittedly a silly example, but this remains to this day a problem in science. We can never really, really be certain that just because a theory works, it is true. It might seem true, all the data might fall into place according to the theory, but in the end, it could turn out to be false. Now, this is crucial, and it touches on a crucial point, which is really what I want to talk about today. And that is, just because something works, just because the science gets the technology to work, doesn't mean that the theory behind it is true. You see what I'm saying? We tend to think, well, science causes airplanes to fly, and it creates computers, and it made electric razors. That is because it bears practical fruit, that it must be the ultimate arbiter of truth. I mean, how dare anyone, postmoderns or religious people in particular, question science? I mean, to question science, it's to leave yourself open to all sorts of names, all sorts of charges of a hayseed and a hick, you know, and so on, especially to question science in the name of all, in the name of religion. Wow. I mean, science works. We see it all around us. The camera I'm staring into is proof that science works. So how can we dare then question it? Well, let's go back and look at a little history. What about Claudius Ptolemy's Almagest? For 13 centuries, this was the standard scientific treatise on celestial motion. This was the first systematic mathematical treatise to give a complete, detailed, and quantitative account of celestial motions. I mean, the only problem was it was wrong. Ptolemy formulated his whole idea that the stars and the sun and the planets all moved around the Earth. That fundamental flaw, it's about as accurate as flat Earth geography, didn't stop people from using his science and using it successfully too for more than 1,000 years. See, don't miss this point. This whole thing was based on the idea that the Earth is stationary at the center of the universe and everything revolved around it in perfect circles and epicycles and whatnot. You know, I mean, talk about something being wrong. Talk about something being fundamentally flawed at the most basic level. And yet, it worked. It worked. People were able to make incredible predictions on this. They were able to make incredible predictions about it. They could guide ships by it. They built almanacs, or they wrote almanacs on it. They did all this stuff around a science that, at its core, was fundamentally wrong. Nevertheless, it worked. Now, next comes Isaac Newton, whose famous formulations of motion, I mean, you know, on the laws of gravity, it remains one of the greatest scientific achievements ever. We're talking about the law of gravity, that to this day we use to fly rockets, to build bridges, to make missiles. I don't know if you ever saw Apollo 13, and after the craft was greatly damaged. There's a scene where the head of NASA says, well, when the rocket goes around the moon, we're going to let the gravity of the moon kind of project the spaceship back to the Earth. And so it worked. They did it. They were able to use Newtonian gravity and their understanding of gravity to help cast the Apollo 13 craft back to the Earth. But you know, there was a slight problem. Slight problem. Newton's basic stuff was wrong. He based his physics on absolute time, and that was wrong. He based it on space. That was wrong. Absolute space, and that was wrong. Newton knew nothing about curved space. For him, the idea that gravity, that one body may act on another at a distance through a vacuum, he thought it was an absurdity, that he thought no man who had competent faculty could ever fall into believing it. Nevertheless, his laws of physics, at slow speeds anyway, continue to be used every day in the most practical ways possible, even though the theoretical basis for it has been overturned for more than a century. I mean, he was basically wrong. Einstein's general relativity completely overturned the foundation of Newtonian mechanics, even though it still works very well. Now, there's another little dirty little secret in science. You've got general relativity and quantum mechanics. These are two of the most successful scientific theories in history. Each of these have been confirmed to an almost unimaginable accuracy. There's only one problem. As currently formulated, one theory cannot be right if the other is. General relativity and quantum mechanics are really, you know, they're mutually incompatible. And the irony is these are the foundation teachings of modern physics. The foundation teachings of it, and yet one can't be right without the other. It's almost, to use an analogy from Christianity, it's almost as if the death of Jesus contradicted the second coming so that one doctrine couldn't be right if the other doctrine was. That's how fundamental they are. But now here's the irony. One can't be right and the other right, so either one is wrong or both are wrong. Though both quantum mechanics and general relativity have borne practical fruit, particularly from quantum mechanics, from which we get such marvels as transistors, computers, compact discs, and discs and on, something remains fundamentally wrong with our understanding of the science behind them. Again, the basic understanding of the science is something is wrong there, but we can still make it work. Quantum theory in particular works very, very well. It can be used to make mind-boggling accurate predictions. It's used in all sorts of things every day. Yet scientists really are at a total loss to explain quantum theory. I mean, come on. Have you ever read about quantum theory? They don't have the vaguest idea how to try to explain what's going on. These things go on at this level. I mean, one of the ideas they have, it's in a book here, it's called The Fabric of Reality. It's the idea that our universe is just one of an endless number of billions and billions of parallel universes. Because at the quantum realm, things happen only probabilistically. And maybe this will happen in here. Maybe it won't. And in this one theory, it says that they all happen. In the universe, the electron goes through one hole. In a parallel universe, it goes through another hole. In another universe, on and on and on. So there, for every quantum event, there are an infinite number of different parallel universes that immediately break off in order to allow these events to occur. Now, that might seem bizarre, it might seem strange, but, for example, if you read David Deutsch here in The Fabric of Reality, it makes a whole lot of sense. Now, here's the point, though. The point I'm trying to make is nobody really knows what's going on in quantum physics. Nobody really knows what's going on. The theories have boggled their minds, even though we can take the science of quantum theory and we can take it and we can use it because it works. Can you see the point? The science works, but the practical gains from science only prove that we understand the science well enough to, well, get practical gains from it. They don't prove anything about the absolute correctness of the science itself. See, this is a crucial point. Just because the science works, just because we can get it to do things, doesn't mean we have a full grasp of how it all works. And this is a part that people have gotten confused on. And they say, well, science could do this, science does that, science does this, science does that. Therefore, how can we challenge it or how can we question it? Look at all the things it gives us to work. And yes, it does work. It does work, but the question is, we don't necessarily know how it works. And it could work even if, at the most basic level, our understanding of it is flawed. Let me give you an example. Let's take for a minute about medicine, okay? I mean, I could take a pill, and it could make me feel better, even though I, or maybe even those who manufacture it, might not know exactly how it works. You see, how well do you have to understand it for it in order to work for you? I mean, I take an aspirin, and the aspirin relieves some tension. It relieves some pain. Okay, fine. Well, how does it do it? Well, the aspirin does such and such to such and such. Okay, that's fine. But how does it do that? Well, it then does such and such to such and such, maybe going a little deeper and going a little deeper. Maybe we could going from the tissue itself to the chemicals in the tissue, and then from the chemicals in the tissue to the molecules, and maybe we understand that, and maybe even to the atoms. But sooner or later, our understanding stops. We understand it at a certain level, but then at the next level, we're really not sure how it works. We might have theories as to how it works. We might speculate as to how it works. You could develop this theory. You could develop that theory. You could develop this idea. You could develop that idea. But in the end, your theory on how it works could be wrong. But yet again, it works, even though you have a total misconception of why it works. And I still think if you get down far enough in just about anything, you're going to come to a point where you don't understand it anymore. You might be able to use it practically, get practical gains from it. Sure, we split the atom and built the atom bomb, but I'm sure there was a whole lot about the atom and the atom bomb that they didn't understand. And there's probably all sorts of, well, I know there's all sorts of mysteries about the atom today that we don't understand, but it sure hasn't stopped us from being able to use it anyway, despite the great amount of ignorance that we still have. See, the tobacco companies, they've been using this idea for years. I mean, it's like, well, we know smoking does this. All right, well, so we know that if you smoke, it'll do that. And they go to this level. And then, all right, well, we don't understand what happens here. But then they study, all right, yeah, well, we understand it here. But what about this level? Well, we understand that, you know, it'll do this to the cells here. But do we really know how it causes cancer here? And you get down and down and down to where you've got a direct link. But you really don't understand at the bottom line level how it works. And so you say, well, then we really don't know for sure. We got to wait for all the evidence that's in before we can really say that smoking hurts your health or smoking causes cancer or whatever, because we really don't know. We haven't gotten down to that level yet. And I think in anything with science, you can break it down and break it down. And at what point, you know, do you say you fully understand the theory? Because no matter how far you break it down, you dig in, there's always going to be a little further to go, and then a little further more. And at some point, you've got to stop and you guess, and you really don't know. Again, it can still work for you. You can still do great things with what you do understand. But at a fundamental level, there'll be things that you do not understand, you're guessing at. You know, for a long time, folks looked around and they thought there had to be this ether in the universe and everything had to be pervaded with this ether, because it light waves from the sun. I mean, they couldn't go through a vacuum. Something had to propagate the light waves. And so they had all sorts of theories with the ether, and they could make all sorts of predictions with their theories about the luminiferous ether. You know, it had to be there. Well, eventually, in the late 1800s or mid-1800s, Morley did this experiment and showed there was no ether wind. And later on, Einstein debunked the whole notion of the ether wind, even though for years they were having theories based on the ether, which could explain things very, very well. Only that it turned out, like with Newtonian physics, it turned out with Ptolemy's view of the universe, it was all based on a complete misunderstanding of the basic principles. So you see, folks, I guess the point on all this is, you know, we live in an era where science works. I mean, there's no question all around. We see all around us. Every day of our life, we reap the benefits of science and how well science works technologically. I mean, you use it to build bridges, to build airplanes, to make a phone call. Every time you use your laptop, you use your cell phone, you go to the doctor. I mean, and all the equipment in there, all that, this is all based on science. And so much of it worked so well. So we've got this idea, well, it's science. I remember once I got in an argument with somebody over something, and he said, but it's science. And was like, how dare I question science? And again, it's easy to get caught up in that because we live in a day and age where science works. But the question is, like all human knowledge, science, it's still contingent. It's still open to revision, or it's still open to being scrapped. You know, in fact, there was a famous philosopher of science in the previous century, in the 20th century, Karl Popper. And he said that you can never be sure of any scientific theory at all. You know, it might have all this evidence for it, and you believe it, and it works. And then you come along later, and the whole theory itself is completely scrapped because something else came along that explains it even better. And no matter how good that new theory is, no matter how much better the evidence seems to fit, no matter how much better, you know, it's like with my spiders from Mars. Maybe they come up with something better than spiders, invisible spiders from Mars to explain how the book falls. And maybe it is better and works better, and that's fine. But then you never know. Will not somebody come along in another generation and come along with something better? But again, but there's still this idea. I mean, if science is the final arbiter, for many it's become the final arbiter of truth. And then, you know, who are we to challenge it? Sure, science is good and has done a lot of good. But what a tragedy. What a tragedy to sell your soul for something that, you know, for a theory that in one generation is seen as, you know, the greatest harbinger, the greatest scientific truth ever, a theory that in another generation is laughed at as a myth or a joke. Unfortunately, too many folks have been duped and done just that. We need to be careful.